Some neutrinos come from the sun, while others come from cosmic rays interacting with the Earth's atmosphere and dramatic astronomical sources such as exploding stars in the Milky Way and distant galaxies. Ever since neutrinos were discovered in 1956, scientists have hoped to decipher the information these astronomical messengers carry about distant cosmic events, but they rarely interact with regular matter. What's the best place to look for neutrinos? Well, the same continent evoked in Vaughan Williams' Sinfonia Antarctica. But what are neutrinos, and why are scientists so eager to find them? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
How much does it cost to find neutrinos? What do you do with them once you've found them? And what are the practical applications of knowing more about them? Our guest with the answers is Frances Housden, astrophysicist and cosmologist in the physics department at the UW-Madison, who's been working with AMANDA, that's AMANDA all caps, and he's also involved in something called IceCube, an observatory under construction at the South Pole.
And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you for having me.
Is it a masochistic streak that leads you to study something that involves going to Antarctica?
Going to Antarctica is the simple part, especially for me. I'm the theorist on the project, so I don't go further than Christchurch, New Zealand, which is the logistics center of the experiment. There is a streak like that in the experiment to the extent that I have been doing this for more than 20 years. And that's about in big science these days. That's the time scale when you do big projects. I mean, IceCube is not unique. It took more than 20 years to pull this off. So you can imagine that this is a moment of celebration for us.
When you have this...
Even though that it's now that the science starts.
Before we get to the projects, the AMANDA telescope and the IceCube telescope, Norman mentioned in his introduction that you're searching for neutrinos, and we need a really good definition for those of us who are not in physics.
Well, it's actually not that difficult to explain. You know that the universe is filled with light. You go out at night, you look at the stars, you see light. Stars emit light beams, and they come to our eyes, and we make a picture of the sky in our mind. And the next most common particle in the universe is just like light. It's practically indistinguishable. And there are two problems with it. We don't see it with our eyes. It would be a lot easier to do astronomy. And it has actually an advantage over light in the sense that light doesn't go through walls. Neutrinos goes to walls. And so the fact that we are eager to try to do astronomy with neutrinos is that we hope to do things that you cannot do with light, just exploiting this fact. For instance, one of our goals is to try to look deep into black holes, which you cannot do with light. And the problem then is that's the other side of the coin. As it goes through everything, it also goes through your detector. And it's very difficult to stop these particles. And it has been known since the 70s that you have to build these huge kilometer-scale detectors to have any chance to see neutrinos beyond the sun. You know, we see neutrinos from the atmosphere. That's kind of our background. It's like we always look through the universe, through the clouds, which are the neutrinos from the atmosphere. They are interesting for other reasons. We may go into that later. We are not interested in seeing the sun. That has been done. So since the 70s, people wanted to build these detectors that could see beyond the sun. And I always like to say this was a technological challenge. I mean, at some point, you could have asked us, we would have forgotten why we were doing this. This was all about showing that we found a way to build a kilometer cube detector. And at some point, this was a race because people had other ideas how to do this. And for the moment, you know, we are the only ones who have achieved this. And here it is, and it's taking data.
So how do neutrinos compare their matter, their particles, you say?
Yeah.
How do they compare in size with, say, an electron?
Ah, I made the comparison not with electrons, but with light. So they are more like a light wave. And, you know, I don't want to teach you quantum mechanics here, but, you know, in quantum mechanics, there's really no difference between a wave and a particle.
Really?
So light is made out of, you can think of a light beam coming from the stars to your eyes. You can think of it in terms of particles or in terms of light waves. And so that's the same for neutrinos. And so they are, so in the sense, light is also high energy light. It's also made of particles. And the only difference between a particle of light and a neutrino is that a neutrino has a tiny mass. That's irrelevant for our subject today. That's another problem. So it's identical to light, except for the fact that it doesn't interact with anything, unlike light.
Does it travel? You know? Does a neutrino travel at the speed of light?
Yes, exactly.
And particles can do that?
Yes. It has, because it has this tiny mass, it doesn't quite travel at the speed of light. But that's a detail in this context. In fact, we our neutrinos don't know that they have mass. So it's exactly like light.
And so is it like a little neutron? Is that what it sort of means? And it doesn't have a positive or negative electric charge?
It's a good comparison in the sense that it doesn't have an electric charge. Because if it did have an electric charge, so why don't we do astronomy with neutrons? They are much easier to detect. The answer is they don't live long enough.
They don't live long enough?
Yes. They don't. They
I guess
have
I didn't know they were alive.
No, no.
They don't exist as individual entities.
They decay. They have a finite lifetime, and then they disappear. They decay into a proton, an electron, and a neutrino. They transform themselves in neutrino. So some of the neutrinos actually that we want to detect are probably produced, start their life as neutrons that lived out their lives and decay. Now, with the lifetime of a neutron, you could look beyond the sun, but you couldn't even look to the center of our own galaxy, except that for a few neutrons whose energies are very high and they are very rare, they have not been seen. But this is a good introduction, again, another way of looking at this. You do astronomy with light, and now we're trying to do astronomy with neutrinos. And the neutrino is totally unique, because by the time that the particle is very long-lived, we don't know, actually. One of the things we may discover, actually, is that over distances of and over times of the universe, neutrinos may not be stable. They may also decay. We know they live very long. I mean, we have seen them in 1987 from a supernova explosion in our own galaxy. We discovered in 87 some 20 neutrinos from a supernova collapse in the Large Magellanic Cloud. And this is also, I mean, something that you have to realize. We are looking not for beams of neutrinos. We are looking for 4 or 5 interesting particles per year in a huge background of neutrinos produced in the atmosphere.
This is a cloud or a supernova that was observed in 1987, meaning, though, that it was many light years away. So how could these neutrinos, if they don't last that long,
That's why we know it at least lives long enough to travel from the outskirts of our own galaxy. But over the distance of the universe, these are the neutrinos the farthest away we have ever seen. Right. And that sets the limit. But we don't know that from another galaxy they may never reach us. That's something we may find out because they decay. Now, this would be an enormous discovery, not for astronomy, but for particle physics. I have to tell you, most of us on this experiment are particle physicists, and we really are as interested in the neutrinos themselves as in the astronomy. Just to be honest about it, the astronomy sells better.
Well, just so I get a picture of it, is it something where right in this radio studio there are neutrinos?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Okay, yeah. So if we just sort of try to bring it closer to home, because it's very difficult if you're trying to envision something having to do with black holes and galaxies and so on. But within this space, the air that we have in this small studio, how are the neutrinos functioning in a way, you know, I mean, we have lights that are turned on, we have various charges in here.
They are not functioning. That's
just,
the answer.
How would you prove?
Just go through you. There's no way you can ever be aware of them.
And how can you prove they're even here?
How do we prove them exist? We detect them with ice cube. It takes a lot of work to prove. Well, the neutrino was in the theoretical concept that such a thing had to exist goes back to actually the decay of the neutron. Because when a neutron decays, if there were no neutrinos, it would decay in a proton and a positron. And, you know, it would be simple billiard ball physics to conserve momentum and energy. And people knew it didn't work. So there was an unseen particle that they couldn't catch that ran away with the energy and momentum. And that was known since the 1930s. It was suggested as a solution to this puzzle by Pauli. In fact, the alternative was to decide that energy wasn't conserved. And no physicist could really take that step, except Niels Bohr, by the way. So this was the cheap way out. And so this is neutrino physics, right? This was early 1930s.
Well, theoretical.
And it wasn't this was a theoretical concept until Reines and Cowan had the idea of putting a neutrino detector, much smaller than Ice Cube, but they put it where there were lots of neutrinos. That's right up to a nuclear reactor, and they discovered a neutrino. But this was 25 years later. So the natural timescale of everything in neutrino physics is 25 years. That's why they're so difficult, because they're so difficult to detect. If you take all the cosmic rays that come from the sun, the atmosphere, and everything, we know enough about neutrino physics, I can compute that only one neutrino in your lifetime, you know, an average person living 70 years, only one neutrino will actually stop in your body.
Will actually stop?
It will actually stop rather than go through.
Oh, because it's
That's
dying
the probability.
There or
what? Well, they interact eventually. Some interact,
they do.
Right? Like in Ice Cube is this huge detector, and a million will go through it for one that we detect. And in fact, if you take a kilometer cube and you scale it to the size of your body in 70 years, you pretty much get the same rate as we get in Ice Cube.
But so, but millions of these are passing through you in what interval of time?
Well, it's always a number I refuse to quote and I because it doesn't mean anything. But the sun alone sends hundreds of billions.
So we're constantly drenched
in neutrinos. Yeah, you're constantly drenched in it. Yeah,
and
you're
so,
not aware of it.
And is there any way to give us a sense of just how tiny a particle would be?
Well, I mean, the photon has no size. It has a wavelength, and the neutrino is like that. You think of it as a photon. It has a wavelength. It has an energy. In fact, that's the basic logic for building a neutrino telescope comes from this analogy. We do astronomy with our eyes, and eventually your eyes can be aided by telescopes or by CCDs instead of your eyes. But you do it with normal light. But then people have figured out over decades, when you look at photons of different wavelengths, like infrared, ultraviolet, and you take a picture of the sky, then you see different things. In fact, you see things you haven't seen before. If you look at the same object, it may look totally different. And this has kind of been exploited all the way from radio waves to gamma rays. And so that are kind of the boundaries of astronomy. And so the neutrino is kind of the only frontier of how to make a different picture of the sky that hasn't been taken before. And even though it's very difficult, this idea of working, of looking at taking pictures of the universe in different wavelengths has been so successful that people have been thinking about this since the neutrino was discovered. I was lucky enough to know Reines before he died, who discovered the neutrino. And he said it was very strange because the idea of neutrino astronomy emerged to everybody as soon as they know the neutrino was real. I mean, it was not a sudden discovery. Once they knew it was real, they immediately make the next step. Oh, we can do astronomy with this. And then it took only like another 10 years to begin to figure out that you need these enormous detectors, which was totally out of the question. But people started to try to build things like Ice Cube, not in ice, but in water, since the early 70s.
And what's the advantage of Ice Cube being in ice when it comes to detecting and seeing with neutrinos?
Well, people always think when I'm joking, but the one-line answer is the advantage of ice is that you can walk on your experiment. And there is a very true message in this, in the following sense. People build neutrino detectors like at Fermilab, which is 2 hours south of here, or at CERN in Geneva. They build neutrino detectors, and they are big but much smaller than what we build. So the size of the detector that can act as a telescope is such that you cannot afford to buy the material
right.
to build it. In fact, I could build a neutrino detector. In fact, I had to go through this exercise when we first proposed Ice Cube using the techniques they use at Fermilab. And at the time, it cost about $10 billion. And nobody, no matter how exciting you think this is, nobody's going to give you $10 billion.
Probably not even the military.
And so what it means is that you basically have to find a detector that already exists in nature. And what we need to detect neutrinos, we haven't gone into that yet, but what you basically need is a large volume of optically very clear material. And so it was known, the proposal came from some Russian physicist in the 1960s, actually, that if you instrumented a large volume of deep ocean water, then you could build such a detector. And in fact, this was tried off the coast of Hawaii. People tried to build a detector like Ice Cube in water that was 4 kilometers deep. And that's just very difficult because your strings move in the current, the temperature of the water changes. I mentioned the word string. We haven't. Your detectors, which are deployed on strings and are kind of floating buoyant from the bottom of the ocean. That's how this experiment was built. And so they are exposed to the elements, and they are constantly exposed to these enormous pressures of being deep in ocean water. In other words, probably they started this too early and the technology didn't deliver. They deployed a string of sensors, and it lived for 24 seconds, and the Department of Energy took their funding away, which was a big mistake, by the way, because with what we know now, I think these people could probably have succeeded.
Still do the underwater.
Because the Europeans have built a small experiment like this in the Mediterranean. It's kind of a proof of concept. And if you look at the difficulty of doing this, probably the Hawaii project would eventually have succeeded as well. Well, that's history. Then we pioneered here in Wisconsin in the late 80s already, the idea of doing this in ice. And now you can see the obvious advantages. When you put a sensor in ice, once you get it there, it's frozen in. Nothing happens to it. It's at constant temperature. It doesn't move. Nobody can touch it. It's the ideal environment to put a relatively sophisticated piece of equipment. Electronics love ice at minus 50 degrees. And then the other advantage is, you have to get your signals out. So you just have a cable that goes to a computer, which you put on top at the ice. In the case of water, your cables go 20 kilometers away somewhere to shore, which adds to the complexity of the experiment. So data transmission is kind of trivial for us. So that the walking on the experiment. And in fact, amazingly, we could actually convince the National Science Foundation, you know, if someone comes and tells you what they're doing off the coast of Hawaii, we can do much better. You just fly to the South Pole, put detectors 2 kilometers deep in the ice and take data. But we could sell the idea. We did it.
It has to be at the South Pole.
Ah, now why the South Pole? No, it could. There are probably places that may be better. The problem is you need this experiment, though it's kept as simple as possible because of the hostile environment, it's still a relatively complex experiment, and you need an infrastructure to do this. This is the type of experiment you would do in Geneva or at Fermilab. And fortunately, the National Science Foundation has this research station at the South Pole that's sitting on 3 kilometers of ice. And so that was the obvious place to do it. In fact, if you had to build the infrastructure, you couldn't afford it. It's only the marriage of the ice, the station, that made this possible.
We're going to talk about the Ice Cube experiment and Antarctica itself when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Frances Hausen, who is filling us in about the search for neutrinos. And I think we should first revisit what neutrinos are and how important are they to the structure of the universe that we can experience directly.
Well, as I already said earlier, it's a form of light, and if you think of the light in terms of particles, there are almost as many neutrinos as particles of light in our universe. Now, there's a totally different way to look at a neutrino. It is a subatomic particle, and having been a particle physicist in my earlier life, we think of neutrinos as a constituent of matter. I always joke that you didn't get your money's worth in high school because you were taught that matter was made of nuclei and electrons, and the nuclei were made of protons and neutrons. If that was the full story, we wouldn't be here, because the neutrino is the essential fourth particle in the quartet that makes up normal matter. In fact, without a neutrino, nuclear physics wouldn't be possible. There wouldn't be any nuclear reactions. So is that bad? There wouldn't be nuclear bombs, for instance. Well, it's really bad because the sun is a nuclear reactor. And so the sun wouldn't shine without neutrinos. And stars basically, at the end of their lifetime, explode because of neutrinos and made all the elements that you and I are made of. So I think that neutrino plays a very critical role in our life, at least for the two reasons I mentioned.
So important safety tip, take care of those neutrinos.
Yes, exactly.
And so back to the Ice Cube experiment that is getting all this attention right now. This is if I follow you right, this is a UW-Madison-led but global venture to create a giant neutron observatory at the South Pole to try in ice in some way or other that I don't understand, but to try in a giant form in ice to detect these neutrinos.
We actually haven't gone into how we detect them, because with the introduction I just gave, it's not difficult to explain. If you have a neutrino that actually, rather than going through our detector, stops, what it does is it hits the nucleus of an ice atom head on and makes a tiny nuclear reaction, just like the nuclear reactions in nuclear reactors in the sun. It makes a tiny nuclear reaction. And that reaction emits blue light. In fact, you may have seen pictures of a nuclear reactor covered with water. The water has always this eerie blue glow. So we detect the nuclear reaction, not from a nuclear reactor, but made by one neutrino crashing into a nucleus of ice. And so that makes a very weak pulse of blue light. And so the ice, as we found out, we're really lucky to find out, is incredibly transparent to blue light. So here and there, we put a light sensor in the ice, and it detects this blue light. And so from the blue light and the shape of the emission, we not only can deduce that the neutrino interacted somewhere in or close to your detector, but we can also find the direction it came from. So you not only have a neutrino detector, you have a telescope because you know where it came from. Now, interestingly, and I should add this immediately, originally we were only actually looking at neutrinos that came through the Earth, because only neutrinos can come through the Earth, and that's the way we were sure we were detecting neutrinos. When we look up at the sky, like you do when you go out at night, we just see this background from the atmosphere, which creates an enormous number of particles in which the neutrinos are lost. We are now developing techniques to look in all directions. But originally, we basically, you know, you build a detector at the South Pole, you look at the sky above Madison.
And so the advantage of looking at these neutrinos that come through the Earth is that there are far fewer distractions there.
Yes, that's right.
And in effect, the Earth is acting like a big filter.
That's right.
For all that other stuff.
Yes, it just filters anything out but neutrinos.
Do you have to worry about global warming when you're doing an ice experiment?
Yeah, but we hope to run this experiment for at least 20 years. So over that time scale, we fortunately don't have to worry about global warming.
So the ice stays constant?
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, this is interesting. The South Pole is on a glacier that runs off the West Antarctic mountain range. And so our experiments moves just under 10 meters every year.
With the glacier.
But it moves very uniformly. Now, we have a block of 1 kilometer cube instrumented with sensors. So the glaciologists who study glaciers are incredibly interested in our experiment because nobody has ever instrumented a block in a glacier that big. So we are trying to detect motions that are not uniform. But up to now, we only, I mean, to the precision of our measurements, which are getting very good, by the way, we now can tell where every sensor is up to 2 feet over this enormous block of ice. But, you know, the experiment just moves uniformly.
And I assume no problem. Ice at the South Pole is much clearer than you might find on Lake Winnebago?
Well, I always worry. The answer is yes. And I always have had the thought that other people had thought about doing this experiment, but they knew more glaciology than I did. In fact, when we were well into this experiment, we discovered a whole literature of people who measured the transparency of bubble-free ice in a lab. And they found numbers like 10 meters. And I think we now know why they found 10 meters and we found 100 meters and more. But, you know, it took us, I don't want to take any credit for this. We put the sensors in the ice. The first sensors we put in were in 93. And we couldn't believe it. It took us more than a year to convince ourselves that we were actually seeing light traveling over 300 meters. I mean, you cannot make a substance that clear in the lab.
Really?
Now, why is it? There's a very simple answer. The ice under the South Pole is made out of an inch or two of snow that falls on Antarctica every year and then by pressure is compactified. In fact, we see different layers of ice with different optical properties.
Oh,
and we are mapping these, and so that's part of understanding your detector. But so a typical layer of ice in Ice Cube is snow that fell on Antarctica 50,000 years ago and is totally pure. Hmm. In fact, to come back to the experiments that got the wrong answer, they didn't get the wrong answer. what the answer they got was connected to the purity of the water they used. So if you actually take water and keep purifying, it becomes more and more transparent.
Right.
So the transparency of tap water to blue light is like 2 meters. It's what we call the absorption length. It's 2 meters. If you distill it, it's 8 to 10 meters. But if you keep purifying it, in the lab they manage to make water where the absorption length is like 100 meters. Ultra-pure water.
So compared
so,
to South
so
Polar
then it
ice.
Becomes comparable. I mean, we have ice that's as bad as 100-meter absorption length. That's bad. Mm-hmm. We've seen ice where it's almost 300 meters.
And I know you said that you mostly stay in New Zealand. You don't have to go all the way there. But I'm trying to picture this giant ice cube experiment. Take me there as if I'm going there. What would I actually see? How big is it? And, you know, is it below the surface where you all you see is sort of the computers
on
top?
Well, if you want to see the experiment, you miss the opportunity because it was built in Stoughton at the Physical Sciences Laboratory. So every piece of experiment that is at the South Pole was at some point in Stoughton, Wisconsin. What you would have seen over the years, when you go there, the only thing you see are 86 cables coming out of the ground. And when I say cables, I mean cables. These are things which have a diameter of a couple of inches that carry the information from all these sensors. And they go into a 2-story building, which we call the Ice Cube Lab. And that 2-story building is filled with computers that digest this data. So that's all you see at the South Pole is computers and cables coming out of the ground.
And how much of the ground then? How big a...
Well, if you look on top of it, these cables come out of... We instrument... So let's go back to the numbers. So the detector starts 1.5 kilometers and then goes on under the surface of the ice. Then we instrument 1 kilometer and then there is still 0.5 kilometer left to the bedrock. The depth of the ice is 3 kilometers. And so we also in the other directions, if you look at the surface of the detector, it's, although you cannot see it because it's 1.5 kilometer deep, it covers 1 kilometer square. So it's a kilometer cube volume that's filled with these sensors. So when you are at the surface, the cables come out of an area that's 1 kilometer square of ice.
Is it considered a telescope then?
Well, it's a telescope as soon as we discover a neutrino that comes from beyond the sun. In the meantime, it's a neutrino detector, which does, by the way, many other things than astronomy. I've already alluded to that.
But the thing with the neutrinos is that it's not good enough to have it pass through. You need to actually stop one occasionally to learn what you want to know.
Yeah. In fact, we have become very good at this with the detector that's in place now. We will detect 220 neutrinos every day. And so that's 2 orders of magnitude larger. The biggest previous experiment is in the Japanese Alps. It's called the Super Kamiokande experiment. And they see about 2 neutrinos every day. So we are roughly a factor of 100 larger.
So let me play devil's advocate and ask the sort of so what question. And you know, I'm assuming this is a very expensive project. As you said, it took many years to build it, construct it, work on it, and so on. And, you know, in terms of practical application, for someone who's listening and thinking, well, why wouldn't that money be invested in healthcare problems here in the United States or in solving a hunger problem or AIDS crisis or something. What good is an experiment that helps us see some neutrinos?
Well, there are 2 answers to this question. The first answer is something we may debate. Okay, I think that dabbling in cosmology, by the way, Ice Cube is one of the most sensitive detectors to look for dark matter. So that's why where my end of the cosmology comes in. And I always like to joke with people in humanities. You know, I always tell them, you are looking for our place in the universe, but we are much more successful at this than you are. We have actually got answers. And so I think that finding our place in the universe is part of our culture. And it's not any different from doing any astronomy, from anything that's done in the philosophy department. It's human knowledge. And I hope that we never decide to drop out of that. We could. But then there is a second answer about dropping out of something. It has been clearly understood that you cannot decouple fundamental research from applied research. It is not only understood, it has been proven. Japan, twice since World War II, decided that they were going to invest all their money in applied research. It sounds like a good idea. Well, they made the mistake twice. They are not making it at this point anymore. The thing is that applied and fundamental research are coupled. And they are coupled in a completely random way. You fund fundamental research, you don't know which project is going to lead to something like a laser that will eventually, you know, fix your eyes. Or you don't know which project will be purely intellectual and never give anything useful. Now, most projects like ours, I mean, push technology and obviously contribute that way. But it's really the serendipitous connection that counts. And my favorite example, my previous employment was at the Center for Nuclear Research in Geneva, which has nothing to do with nuclear physics. It has to do with particle physics. But to collaborate on an experiment that was done in Geneva with three universities that were spread over Europe, they invented the web. And, you know, they didn't do this because, I mean, in fact, I don't think they had any idea of what would happen later and that it would have economic value. I mean, I'm sure that the web is bigger than Detroit now, even before it. Things didn't go well in Detroit. And so that's the connection. And, you know, I could go on the rest of the hour giving examples of this. But I think this has been understood. If you don't do fundamental research, you become a developing nation. The only thing is you don't know how long it will take. The other line that you always produce in this, that most of the U.S. economy is based on quantum mechanics. There was nothing more fundamental than quantum mechanics in the 1920s. Now, GPS works by it, your cell phone works, everything works by quantum mechanics. By the way, GPS wouldn't work if it weren't for general relativity.
Really?
There is one piece of physics we do that you would consider totally useless and purely intellectual in general relativity, but its effects now are essential in achieving the kind of resolution that our present GPS systems do. That's a different program, I guess.
Well, let's find out in a moment what exactly you hope to learn about neutrinos down there at the South Pole through this Project Ice Cube. When we return shortly, this is University of the Air.
Culminating a decade of planning, innovation, and testing, construction of the world's largest neutrino observatory, installed in the ice of the Antarctic Plateau at the geographic South Pole, was successfully completed December 18, 2010, New Zealand time. From its vantage point at the end of the world, the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory provides an innovative means to investigate the properties of fundamental particles that originate in some of the most spectacular phenomena in the universe. The University of Wisconsin-Madison, as the lead U.S. institution for the project, was funded by the National Science Foundation to manage and coordinate the work needed to design and build the complex and often unique components and software for the project. That's from a press release about the construction of Ice Cube, a neutrino observatory. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, And our guest for the hour, Frances Hulzen, as we're talking about the UW-Madison project that has just successfully been launched. Well, I guess if I pictured this giant ice cube neutrino observatory, one of the first things that comes to my mind is the difficulty it must have created for scientists to try to do anything in Antarctica, just the logistics of it.
It's interesting to listen to this press release because my impression of the same words was that it was an incredible roller coaster with a sequence of events where we were sure we had failed and a sequence of events where we couldn't believe our luck, like when we discovered this ultra-transparent ice that nobody had anticipated. So it's slightly different from that. But I guess what we are celebrating is the construction, and the construction was less of a roller coaster than the science. And when you stand in front of committees who review your project, which I do several times a year, I must have really stood in front of the time of the project in front of close to 100 committees. And they always ask you, when you lay awake at night, what are you thinking of? And there was my answer up to 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, was always the same, drilling. We tend to discuss science and everything, but the logistics of drilling these holes was incredible. It was clear that in order to hold these projects within the boundaries of the cost of a neutrino detector, we couldn't afford to do this construction over more than 5 years. So you drill 86 holes in 5 years. You only have December and January to do this at the pole. It's too cold before and after.
Oh, that's right.
So you have to do this in
summer.
two months a year. Mm-hmm. And so you can easily work out, we all did, you need a power plant. You need to melt the ice with a power plant of 4.8 megawatt. That's what we built. So this, in the most elementary form, this is like 40 car wash heaters. When you go and wash your car wash, that's basically what you use. They're a little bit more sophisticated and upgraded. So that's the easy part. But then you run into troubles. You cannot go, if you want to do drilling, you typically go to a company in Texas and they do it for you or you buy it. This is a different business. You don't drill. You really melt the ice over 2.5 kilometers. And by the way, over the time of the project, we learned to do this in less than 2 days.
You have to keep it melted too, don't you, for those other 10 months of the year.
That's just physics.
Uh-huh.
Once the water is liquid, ice is an insulator. It's like in a thermos bottle.
Oh.
And so you have days to deploy your equipment before it freezes back. In fact, we're sometimes, you know, waiting for this ice to freeze back because we don't take data until the water has become ice. And so that's the relatively easy part. But you cannot go and buy this drill in Texas. So this thing was designed and put together by a combination of people that range from very talented engineers at the Physical Sciences Laboratory and at SSEC here on campus to physics graduate students. But in the end, it worked. And we went from the first hole that took 2 weeks to drill to the last few years when holes were drilled under 2 days. Routinely. So you may ask, what progress did you make between 2 weeks and 2 days? And the only difference was that the drillers became familiar with the equipment, and we put together a crew of incredibly talented people and convinced them to come back every year. Most work in Antarctica is done by a group of people who work for 3-4 months and then go off and have a good time, which may involve work or which may not. And so our project manager, Jim Yek, had a brilliant idea to tell them that if they came back the next year, they would pay health insurance the full year. And so we had a very trained crew. And I mean, this, in fact, when the last string was deployed, the drilling crew, who I know very well by now, sent me a message, and their message said, "We made the impossible look easy."
Well, the South Pole, speaking of health insurance, is a pretty healthy place, isn't it? You're not going to catch germs.
I don't think so.
It's a little too cold for them.
On the other hand, a 4.8 megawatt power plant is a dangerous object, so we worried a lot about safety. And your closest hospital is in New Zealand.
And how far away is that?
The typical road from Madison to South Pole is you go to Los Angeles, then fly to Christchurch, New Zealand, and there the NSF takes over. Their NSF flights take you to McMurdo on the coast of Antarctica. That's about, depending on the plane, it's of the order of 9 hours. It can be less with some planes. And then it's another 3-4 hours flight to the pole. So that's the normal way. But the closest real hospital, there are doctors. There's a doctor at the South Pole, even in winter. But we only had one incident, really, where someone had to be evacuated to Christchurch, New Zealand.
You had to have, I presume, some kind of a mock-up for this whole telescope that was a good deal smaller than a kilometer. You had to have some kind of a model to prove at least that it would probably work.
The Amanda experiment, which stands, by the way, I never liked that name, for Antarctic Muon and Neutrino Detector Array. It was a mock-up in the sense it was 100 times smaller than IceCube. But we showed that we could detect neutrinos with something that small. We could certainly do it with a kilometer cube experiment. And so that was essential. So we built this experiment between 1993 and 2000 and then ran it for 9 years. But then once IceCube became big enough, it became relevant and we turned it off. That was a very emotional moment for all of us. Yeah.
Rite of passage.
Yeah.
And now that you've had the IceCube Observatory up and operating for a month, you know, you're just starting, I assume, to get data. And I'm wondering, too, like if we had you back in 2 years, what is it you're hoping that you would be able to have discovered in that time using this new giant observatory?
The top of my list is that I come back here and talk about something that I don't know about today. That's really the ultimate, is to discover something that you just haven't thought of. By the way, we submitted a proposal for IceCube in 1999, I mean, over a decade ago. And most of the things we are doing were never mentioned in the proposal.
For instance, because you didn't know about them.
Well, you know, I mean, for instance, one of the priorities of this experiment, you know, we are all waiting for another supernova explosion like in 1987. And if we run this experiment for 20 years, we have a good chance. There hasn't been one since 87, so we're due for one. And seeing one supernova explosion with this really fantastic setup, that would justify the experiment all by itself. So I would be happy to come back here in 2 years and we haven't seen anything but a supernova explosion. You know, it was something where we would see few events, but it would generate more papers than events. I mean, that's what 87 was like. But then to come back to what we call the bread and butter, you have to have goals that explain why you are building a kilometer cube detector and not a 10 kilometer cube detector. That's the bread and butter physics. And so there, I think we have three priorities. One is in astronomy, one is in cosmology, and one is in particle physics. And when you look at the distribution, I mean, if I haven't said it yet, I should say it. The construction is very much a Madison Center thing, but the scientific IceCube collaboration are about almost 300 people now in 35 universities and 7 countries. And so the construction couldn't have happened without that pool of people available, because you don't just go and drill. I mean, you have to design this experiment. There's electronics that has to be designed, built, tested. So, I mean, this collaboration was critical. Of course, now they analyze data. And about a third of them is doing astronomy. And what that means at the moment is we're looking for the sources of the cosmic rays. Cosmic rays were discovered by Victor Hess in 1912. And I always used to give talks that 100 years later, we will know where the cosmic rays come from.
It gives you a year.
Well, I'm not so sure. I'm very careful. I hope I'm still right. But so we theorists expect that these sources emit neutrinos. And so I'm rather sure that the first sources we will see should be, in all likelihood, the sources of the cosmic rays. And this is the oldest problem in astronomy. You know, these are particles with fantastic energies, much larger energies than we produce with accelerators. They bombard us continuously. We know some are accelerated in our galaxy, some outside. We have no clue how or where. And so this would be a big deal. So this is our astronomical project. Now, the other large group, mostly the Europeans, are looking for dark matter. Where there is large amount of dark matter particles accumulated, like in our sun, they occasionally, these dark matter particles, talk to each other. And in doing so, they make neutrinos. So we are looking for those neutrinos. The last thing is, of course, we detect neutrinos in numbers and energies, and with energies that have never been available before. So we study the neutrinos themselves. And that's the particle physics side. And then there are, I mean, you wouldn't believe what people are doing in this experiment. I won't make the mistake I once did when I was giving a talk in Washington. And someone asked what my reasons were for this experiment. And I said, I have 42 reasons. And the man who asked it was from the Office of Management and Budget, didn't get the joke. And he said, can you send them to me? And I said, yes, and I did.
And you probably had a few to spare.
I think you don't want me to go into the rest of the questions, but like just to mention one kind of off-the-wall idea, which I'm sure will work eventually. I already mentioned neutrinos come through the Earth. And so the neutrinos can actually, some of them, many of them, stop in the Earth. We are only collecting one in a million of what get through the Earth. And they stop more in the direction of the core of the Earth, which is denser than the mantle.
Right.
So what we hope by measuring the neutrino direction is to eventually see the transition of from the core to the mantle. And you say, well, we know there is a core and a mantle. Yes, but it has never been observed directly. Nobody thinks this is interesting, except the geologists themselves. They think this is very exciting. It's a bit like we all know gravitational waves exist, but we will still be excited when LIGO or some experiment like them actually detects them.
Well, and as you say, there's no telling what the ramifications will be.
And by the way, a large fraction of us have forgotten about neutrinos and are doing glaciology. I think you have already picked that up from some of my previous answers. Yeah.
Our guest this hour has been Francis Halsen talking about the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory. Thanks for being our guest.
Pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach of Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.